Americans have long had a fascination with King Tut, the youthful Egyptian pharaoh whose life and death are a mystery in so many ways. His tomb and its many treasures were discovered 95 years ago. It's been a highly protected Egyptian national treasure ever since. More than 1,000 precisely crafted reproductions of the tomb artifacts will be on display at the St. Louis Science Center starting this Saturday and running until January 7th. The exhibit is titled The Discovery of King Tut. Who better to tell us about the king, the artifacts, and life in ancient Egypt than one of the foremost authorities on the subject, author, Egyptologist Bob Breyer. He is a senior research fellow at Long Island University. Bob, welcome to St. Louis.
Thanks, Don.
Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Well, are you pretty excited about this?
Yeah, I think the exhibit's going to be wonderful, and the Tut story is something that everybody loves, so I think it's going to be a great time.
Well, we want to find out more about that Tut story, but Americans have long since been fascinated with this king. Why do you think we are so?
I think there's about three or four reasons. One is, of course, the treasure. It's the only tomb ever found for a pharaoh that was intact. So we've got all the treasure. So it's got, you know, the gold, the glimmer, and all of that. And it's got fabulous art, wonderful art. But also inside the tomb, which is important to me, is the mummy. We have actually Tutankhamun. We don't just have the treasures. We've got the king himself. So that's part of it. And I think part of it is the story of the discovery. You know, you have this impoverished archaeologist. I mean, that may be a redundant term, but he's an impoverished archaeologist, Howard Carter, who has searched for the tomb for 7 or 8 years with the wealthy Lord Carnarvon funding him, and they're having a hard time of it. And then at the last minute, they find this thing. So it's a wonderful success story. It's got treasure. It's got everything going for it.
Did he strike it rich in any sense by having found this tomb?
Not in his own sense. He became famous, of course, world famous. But, you know, Carter came from the wrong side of the tracks. He wasn't an educated gentleman. So, for example, I mean, surprisingly, he was never knighted by the king or queen. No, he was never knighted. And he died a bit impoverished, sort of not well known. So, no, he didn't strike it rich. It wasn't a happy – the high point was the 10 years during which he excavated the tomb. It took 10 years to clear that tomb and document it. It was so chock-a-block with artifacts. And then it was all downhill for Carter.
So what are we going to see at the Science Center? What he saw when he entered the tomb?
Yeah, you actually see – I mean, for me, I was amazed when I saw the exhibition. I've been in the tomb probably 100 times. You know, so I know the tomb very well. I've seen the objects, which are in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, displayed in the museum setting. And I was surprised because when I looked at the replica of the tomb, you can actually see a replica of the tomb itself. It's better than being in the tomb. It really is. Because when you go into the tomb, they only allow you to stand on a platform looking at the burial chamber with the painted walls. You can't get close to the walls. You can't see some of the walls because there's, you know. But so here in the museum, you can see everything and you go right up close to it. So it's even better than being in the tomb. And also the replicas are wonderful. You know, I was afraid they'd be a little cheesy, you know, not looking really like the real thing. Some of them look just fabulous. So you'll get to see what the tomb looked like when Carter first discovered it. You know, they break down a wall. They have a little hole in a wall. Carter holds up the candle, and Carnarvon's looking over his shoulder. What do you see? And Carter says, wonderful things. Yeah. And you'll see that view that Carter had. They reproduced that the chock-a-block tomb. So it's pretty good.
And there's an audio component as well?
Yes, you can get an audio guide for it, yes. And it's a good audio guide. I've heard it. And it's just a wonderful story of the discovery. But also, you know, so you see the tomb as Carter discovers it. But you also see the very large shrines in which the coffin was. You see the artifacts, and that's kind of fun because there were so many artifacts. And some of them are very touching. You know, you see actually his clothes, the things he used in daily life, canes, walking sticks. You see his little kiddie throne, his throne when he becomes king when he's 9 years old or so. So you got this little throne that a little king sat on.
You say it's a kiddie, K-I-D-D-Y, as opposed to kiddie, because cats did play a role.
We'll
get to that in a moment or two.
Yes.
But how did Carter happen to find this thing? I mean, was he looking for it specifically?
Now, the truth is that he didn't happen to find it. He was looking. It's quite interesting. You know, when you excavate in the Valley of the Kings, even today, you have to get what's called a concession, permission from the Antiquities Service to do an excavation. And in those days, they gave only one excavation per area. So, for example, in, say, around 1900, somebody named Theodore Davis had the concession for the entire Valley of the Kings. Mm. A wealthy American from Rhode Island had more money than brains and was excavating in the Valley of the Kings for many years. Theodore Davis found important tombs, important discoveries, not intact tombs, but some plundered tombs that were still important. And then he comes to a tomb that seems to have the name Tutankhamun written on a few broken objects. Good. And then he says he's found the tomb of Tutankhamun. And he says, famous statement, "I fear the Valley of the Kings is now played out." And he gives up the concession.
Wow.
What he had actually found was the little burial pit from the last meal served to the family of Tutankhamun when they buried him. There was a ritual. You would have a last meal by the tomb, and then they would take all the things involved, even the dishes, and break them ritually and bury him in a pit. That's what Theodore Davis found. He thought it was the tomb of Tutankhamun. So he finds this and says, "I give up the concession." Now, Carter knew that this wasn't the tomb, and he knew Tutankhamun was missing. So he starts the search for Tutankhamun. And he got lucky. Lord Carnarvon, who was his backer, and Carter didn't have any money, Lord Carnarvon was involved in the first automobile accident in England, period. First automobile accident. He's got the second car ever in England, and he wraps it around a tree, right? So what happens is he goes to Egypt to recover. That's kind of convalesce. And he's there in Egypt, and he falls in love with the place. And he gets the idea that he'd like to excavate, but he doesn't know how to do it. So he asks the Antiquity Service. He's a wealthy, titled lord, and he says, "I'd like to excavate." And the Egyptians say, "That's fine, but you have to have an archaeologist working with you." And Howard Carter was unemployed at the time. So Carnarvon hires Carter, and they look in different areas. They can't get the Valley of the King yet. That's this guy Davis from Rhode Island. So they're looking in other areas, not much success. And then Davis gives up the concession. Carter says to Carnarvon, "We're going after Tut." So for 7 years or so, they're looking in the Valley of the King, and they don't find it.
You know, I'm a little confused because I think most of us tend to think of the kings being buried in pyramids as opposed to being buried underground.
Yes. Now, this is going to sound counterintuitive, but the pyramids come at the very beginning of recorded Egyptian history. The pyramids were 1,000 years old when Tutankhamun lived. They were ancient monuments to Tutankhamun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Pyramids are built as tombs. You're absolutely right. Pharaohs are buried in pyramids. But after a while, the era of pyramid building was over. I think the pharaohs realized they were big rob me signs. You know, tomb robbers saw these big hulking things. And in times of lawlessness, when the government had declined, they went after the pyramids and knew there was treasure in them. So all the pyramids had been robbed. So at some point, the pharaohs said, "We're going for something different. We're going for hidden tombs." And the first pharaoh in the Valley of the Kings was somebody named Thutmose I. And his architect, we even have the architect's name in Neni, he has on his autobiography on his tomb, he says, "I made for my pharaoh a secret tomb, no one seeing, no one knowing." So that was the first tomb in the Valley of the Kings. And then they start to be buried underground.
I say, no caves or that sort of thing, basically just graves.
Usually graves that you dig way down deep into the bedrock, and then you have chambers inside, burial chambers and antechambers and all that, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about this young king, King Tut. Tell me about him. I mean, he took the throne when he was 9 years old.
Yes. He lives at a unique time in Egyptian history. His father is the pharaoh Akhenaten, who was a heretic. Akhenaten is the first pharaoh in Egypt to say there's only one God. As far as we know, Akhenaten is the first monotheist in history. This is before Moses,
really?
Before the Jews. Yeah, and, you know, Egypt had more than 2,000 gods. And then this pharaoh comes along and says, there's only one, the solar disk, the Aten, a sun god. So they're sun worshippers. And he closes all the temples. Now, the people are very unhappy, you know. Look, you're a little old lady, and you've been worshiping all these gods for all these years, and then Pharaoh comes along, no, you can't worship anymore. You know, people were really unhappy. He was an unpopular pharaoh, so much so that he had to move out of the capital and build a new capital in the desert, a holy city on his own, which he called Achet Aten, the horizon of the Aten. And he took with him some followers, like maybe 20,000 followers with him to the desert, and he builds this, you know, city, religious city in the desert. And that's where little Tut is born. He's not born in all the temple where all the temples are in Egypt. He's born in an isolated setting in the desert. And his name isn't Tutankhamun. It's Tutankhaten. See, Tutankhamun means the living image of Amun, but he's born as the living image of the Aten, that one god. So as far as he knows, when he's born and growing up as a kid, there's only one god, the Aten. Then his father dies after 17 years of rule. And what are you going to do? You're living in this isolated city. Do you continue with this new religion, this Atenism or whatever it is, sun worshiping, or do you go back to the old religion? Well, the people were tired of living in isolation. It was decided, we're going back to Thebes. We're going back to the old ways. And little Tut, 9 years old, becomes king of Egypt. He's married to his half-sister, Ankhes and Aten.
At age nine?
Yep. She's about nine, too. They're both about nine. It's a political marriage. Mm-hmm. And he becomes king of Egypt. Then he moved back to Thebes, and he changes his name to Tutankhamun to show he's traditional, not like my heretic father. And then he rules for about 10 years.
Well, I have to assume that at age nine, he probably had some senior advisors helping.
That's a very, very interesting question. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. There seems to be one guy, one senior advisor. His name is Aye, it's spelled. And he is like the prime minister of Egypt. And he's calling the shots. He is making the decisions for little Tut, I'm pretty sure. And he plays an important role, perhaps even in the death of Tutankhamun, but he's calling the shots for sure.
What sort of decisions were called upon of this young king?
Well, of course, one of the big things is, what's the religion going to be? Is it the old one? So that's changed. Uh-huh. But also, when he comes back to Egypt, he's got to decide, where is he going to build his tomb, right? Valley of the Kings is a logical place, right? And he starts building a tomb right next to his grandfather, Amenhotep III, who was a traditional pharaoh. So he's saying, I'm like grandpa, you know. He's trying to show he's traditional. Other things he has to do is he's got to build buildings. Pharaohs built things, you know. They built temples. So he refurbishes temples to Amun. He opens up the old temples, all of these decisions. He even erects a proclamation saying, during my father's reign, the temples were closed. The military went downhill. We were not respected. I will change that. It's almost like his campaign speech. And I is writing that for him. The old prime minister is probably writing it for him. So he's doing the best he can to restore normalcy to Egypt.
I have to take a break, but in a word or two, was he well received? Was he a popular young king?
I think he may have been very popular, mm-hmm. but he was still, I think, murdered.
Right, well, we'll get to that in a moment. We have to take a break. We're talking with Bob Breyer, an author and Egyptologist, and we're talking with him in advance of the opening this weekend at the Science Center of the exhibit, the Discovery of King Tut exhibit. It promises to be very spectacular indeed. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the King Tut exhibit at the St. Louis Science Center, which opens this weekend, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. April's deadly boiler explosion at the Loy Lang Box Company in the Soulard neighborhood was the result of deterioration of steel at the bottom of the tank. That's according to a report released today by the U.S. Chemical Safety Board. The blast killed four employees at the Faultless Linen Company when a piece of the boiler traveled more than 500 feet and crashed through its roof. The Missouri Senate is poised to take up a bill to help reopen an aluminum smelting plant in southeastern Missouri. The measure passed the House yesterday. It will give the Public Service Commission the authority to negotiate a lower utility rate with the Ameren, Missouri folks on behalf of the plant and of a proposed nearby steel mill. If approved without changes by the Senate, the bill will go to Governor Eric Greitens to end the special session. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Egyptologist Bob Breyer, talking about King Tut and the King Tut era. Don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. You mentioned, though, just before the break, you were going to talk about you thought that he was murdered. A couple of questions about his young life. You mentioned that among the artifacts, canes were found, for instance, indicating he might have been crippled somehow.
Some people feel that. I don't think the mummy really, really shows that. I think it was a staves of authority. You know, you would walk with a cane, it would be a symbol of authority.
We've seen Yul Brynner in all the movies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think it was a sign of authority more than that. I don't think the mummy really shows he was crippled.
And he was 19 when he died, is that
just
correct?
Just about, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what's your theory?
Well, the theory is that he was murdered, and there is some evidence. I have to emphasize it's a theory. I haven't proven anything. It's just a theory. But I think it's reasonable. Now, I started with the theory when I was about 20 years ago. I was watching an old BBC document about Tutankhamun. And there was somebody on I'd never seen before, a radiologist who had x-rayed the mummy of Tutankhamun. And he had this x-ray of the cranium, of the skull of Tutankhamun. And he's pointing to it with a pointer, and he's a little bit stiff, and he's got his British accent. And he says, over here is what might be a blow to the back of the head. And this, in turn, could have caused pressure on the brain, which may have caused death. Now, he was very guarded. This might be a blow to the back of the head, which may have caused pressure on the brain, which might have caused death. So this causes me to jump up and down and yell, murder, 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 right? Now, why am I saying murder, right? The reason is I know something about the history of Tutankhamun and his wife that the radiologist didn't know. After Tutankhamun died, from whatever causes, let's just say whatever, his widow, his half-sister, Ankhesenamun, writes a letter to the Hittite king. Now, the Hittites are where modern Turkey is, and they are the traditional enemy of Egypt. Traditional enemy. Ankhesenamun, the widow, writes to the Hittite king and says, we have the letter. She says, my husband has died. I have no sons. They say you have many. Send me one of your sons, and I will make him king of Egypt. Never will I marry a servant of mine. I am afraid. That's quite a letter. And it's such a remarkable thing. I mean, why is the queen of Egypt afraid? What does she mean, never will I marry a servant of mine, a commoner? And why, of all people, is she writing to the Hittite king? It's so strange that the Hittite king didn't believe it. He sends an ambassador to Egypt to see if it's true. The ambassador comes back and says, yes, the king has died. The widow has no son, and she will marry one of your sons. So the Hittite king sends Zanzana, is his name, a prince, to marry Ankhesenamun. And we know what happens to the prince. He's murdered on the borders of Egypt before he can enter. Right? So, so far it's suspicious. And I'm wondering, you know, why is Ankhesenamun afraid? And there's a blow to the back of the head for Tutankhamun. Maybe she knows he's been killed. So it's a remarkable story. And it doesn't end there. What we next have, and people can see this at the exhibit, Tutankhamun's tomb, which shows Tutankhamun's successor performing a ritual of opening of the mouth, it's called, when he would touch the mouth, and he'd say on the mummy of Tutankhamun, you're young again, you live again, you're young again, you live again forever. So Tutankhamun will have breath and life in the next world. And it's being performed by his successor, the next pharaoh. Now, who is the next pharaoh? A commoner, a servant of Ankhesenamun, I, the vizier. And he has become pharaoh. Now, how did I become pharaoh? We know, because we have a finger ring that has his name on it and Ankhesenamun's name on it, meaning they were married. So he marries Ankhesenamun, the widow who's afraid and never wants to marry a commoner. Now what happens next? Ankhesenamun disappears from history. We don't have another word about her, no tomb, nothing. And that's why I think it might be foul play on the Nile.
Agatha Christie is certainly smiling at this moment.
Oh, it's an amazing story. It is. It's an amazing story.
You know, you mentioned at the outset that more important than the artifacts were the fact that you actually have the young king.
Yes.
And the mummy. Why is that important? What does it tell us beyond what you've just said about the head wound?
Well, part of my specialty is mummies. I'm a mummy person.
You're Dr.
So
mummy, I think you're
sort
called.
Of, yeah, sort of. Yeah. But so, as a matter of fact, I mummified a human cadaver in the ancient Egyptian way. It was the first time in 2,000 years, I think, to see how the Egyptians did it. So it's important to learn exactly how did the Egyptians mummify their dead. They were resurrectionists, the Egyptians. They believed the body was going to get up and go again in the next world, so you had to preserve the body. That's why they mummified. So we knew the basics. You know, they took the brain out through the nose. Every sixth grader can tell you that. You know, they took out the internal organs through a small incision. But a lot of the details we just didn't know, so that's why I did that. Well, with the mummy of Tutankhamun, I learned a lot more. We can learn from the mummy the mummification practices. For example, when you look at the x-ray of the skull, you can see that they poured resin, tree sap, through the nasal passages into the skull. After they removed the brain, they weren't sure if they got it all. And they didn't want to leave any in because it would rot. It would decay. Mm-hmm. So they cauterized the area with tree sap by pouring resin into the brain. Right? Now, imagine Tutankhamun lying on his back on a table, and they pour the resin in. So all that resin is going to go through the nasal passages to the back of the skull. Okay, and then it's going to harden. And you can see it hardened on the x-ray. You can see it looks like a liquid line almost. But then there's another liquid line like that, only on the top of the skull. Now, well, how do you get the resin on the top of the skull? Well, they turn the body with the head off the table now. The chin is pointing towards the sky, and then they pour more resin in. So it's going to go through the lowest point, which is now the top of the head. So we can see that they poured resin in twice, moving the body, manipulating it. We can see from the incision how careful they were to remove the internal organ. So we learned a lot from Tutankhamun's mummy about royal mummification.
Did that process continue in this manner? I mean, I know you've done work with the Medicis and with Ramses II, I guess it was, and others.
Yeah.
Same process?
No, it differs quite a bit. You're right. I have worked a bit with modern mummies, as we would call them.
Ava Perón was another one, right?
Evita, yes, Ava. She's the best preserved mummy in the world.
Hmm.
And it's a unique process. I mean, she is spectacular. I mean, so spectacular that when they saw the mummy, they weren't quite sure it was really Evita, and they cut off a finger. I'll tell you the story. Evita was mummified with wax. They waxed her, right? Very different from the Egyptian, right? But it wasn't just pouring wax on top of her. No, no, no. They perfused her with wax. They put wax throughout all her arteries. They removed the blood and replaced it with wax. And it goes into all the tissues, all the cells. So she's not just coated with wax. She's basically a big candle. And she looks fabulous. And when Perón was kicked out, when the Peronistas, as they call, were kicked out, when Juan Perón is kicked out, her body was moved out of Argentina. They didn't want the people to have it as a rallying point. And it was buried in Italy for years. And then it was dug up when the Peronistas come back, and she was displayed next to Juan Perón. And it looked perfect. She looked absolutely perfect. They didn't believe it was the same, person even. So she's fabulous. Lenin's another story. Lenin's a totally different thing. You know, in Red Square in Moscow today, you can still see him. And he's actually not really well preserved. He's wet. Now, he looks fine, right? He looks like a regular mummy. He's got his little Armani suit now on. He used to have his little commie uniform on, and they changed that for an Armani suit. So he looks pretty good. But underneath that Armani suit is a wetsuit like divers wear, and inside that is formaldehyde. And they have to close down that mausoleum every, I think it's 6 weeks, and replace the formaldehyde in the wetsuit. So he's a little high-maintenance mummy. So there are different techniques used in different civilizations. It's not all the same by any means.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, going back to Tut and what folks will be seeing at the Science Center. What about the artifacts? I mean, what kinds of things are folks going to see? A lot of glitter and glitz, I assume.
Yeah, there's a lot of glitter and glitz. You'll see a wonderful reproduction of the gold mask, the famous gold mask. But I think there's other things that are kind of, you don't really see them or talk about them. For example, you'll see what, at first you're not going to know what they are. They look like, how to say it, white cases, little white plastered cases that are about the size of a bowling ball. And you look at them and they're piled up in the tomb. Now, what are they? They're ducks. The inside these white cases are mummified ducks for Tutankhamun to eat in the next world. It's an order to go. It's his last order to go, his Chinese meal. So he was taking food with him to the next world. He was taking his beds with him. You see his little folding stool that he had that folds. His fans that they would to shade him when he was in the sun. His arrows that he used for hunting birds. It's all very touching things. You can see personal items that the pharaoh used, his gloves, for example. So it's really quite a window into life in ancient Egypt, not just a pharaoh and his mummy.
What about hieroglyphics?
You'll see plenty of hieroglyphs. Also on the tomb wall, you will see the tomb wall is a little bit like a newspaper. It's showing the it's showing the death of Tutankhamun. There's one wall that shows the mummy of Tutankhamun in the coffin being pulled on a sled to the tomb by the officials of the palace. And the hieroglyphs above it say just that, the officials of the palace taking the mummy of the deceased pharaoh to the tomb. And then you'll see ceremonies being performed on the pharaoh. And this is all painted on his tomb wall. Very unusual. No other pharaoh had that. It's really unique. So you'll see that too. Plenty of hieroglyphs, plenty of gold, plenty of daily life objects.
I have to go back a moment. Your theory is that he was murdered.
Yeah.
What was the official story back in the day?
There was no official story. I mean, we didn't have We didn't have NPR, we didn't have radio, we didn't have newspapers, we didn't have any of that. So, you know, there was no official story. The pharaoh has died, end of story. And they never publicized the death of a pharaoh anyway. It was a bit of a defeat. So he always ascended to the heaven and that's it.
Now, there were a couple of religions, as you've indicated, that were kind of at play here. The
yes.
one when they went into the desert, the single deity.
Yes.
When he died, what was the deity that they were basically going to assume that he was going to go see in the afterlife?
We don't know. That's a very good question. We don't even know if Akhenaten, his father, believed in the afterlife. We're not sure. You see, all traces of this religion were erased after the death of the father, Akhenaten. The entire city in the desert was taken down to bedrock. All those blocks that were incised with pictures of the pharaoh and things like that were reused in other buildings with the faces turned inward. So we really don't know what they believed the next world would be like or if there was a next world.
You're the Egyptologist. I'm not, but it would seem to me that that's kind of sort of a contradiction of the time because they kept fairly meticulous records, didn't they, historical records?
Yes, they recorded everything, but and maybe Akhenaten did too, but these were all destroyed when he dies and they go back to the old religion. He was a heretic. You know, we don't keep careful records of the people we detested.
Mm. Yeah. True. What about the cats? We've grown up saying that when they find anything, they'll often find the remains of a cat buried with the monarch.
The Egyptians loved cats. They were pet lovers. They mummified cats even. But there were two reasons for mummifying cats. Two reasons. One is, as you suggest, you know, sometimes with a pharaoh, you'll have a pet cat, and that's terrific. You know, you could have that. That was a pet. But also, there was a cat goddess. Her name was Bastet. She was shown as a woman, but with the head of a cat. Now, if you wanted to make an offering at the temple of Bastet, you would buy a mummified cat. You would go to a store that sold mummified cats, and they would raise these kittens to be sacrificed as offerings. So when we find mummies of cats, we find literally hundreds of thousands of mummified cats in catacombs in Saqqara in Egypt. And these cats have been raised to be sacrificed as offerings to Bastet, the cat goddess.
They're pretty quick to mummify just about anything.
If it moved, they would mummify it. Yes, yes. They mummified bulls. They mummified crocodiles. There are hundreds and hundreds of mummified crocodiles, cats, dogs. They mummified it, yes.
How advanced was the society in Tut's day?
Well, I think in many ways it was way ahead of its time. For example, it was the great civilization of the Middle East by any account. But look how far ahead it was of places like England. See, during the time when Egypt is literate, they've got literature, they've got short stories, they've got mythology, they've got hieroglyphs, they can write everything, they're writing their history. England was in the Dark Ages building Stonehenge. You know, they didn't have any no writing. They were in prehistory. So Egypt was way ahead of its time.
Did the famous library at Alexandria exist at this time?
No. The library at Alexandria comes at the very end of Egyptian civilization. Towards the end, Egypt is declining, other civilizations are gaining power, and the Greeks come in. And they are ruled first by Alexander the Great, and then eventually by a pharaoh named Ptolemy. And that's what's called the Ptolemaic era. Yeah. That's 300 years of Greek rule. And it's during this period when the Library of Alexandria is built.
Where does Cleopatra, second only to maybe even more famous than King Tut, fit into all of this?
Cleopatra is the last ruler of Egypt. She is a Ptolemy. People don't realize this, but Cleopatra's Greek. She's a Ptolemy. Her parents were Greek. And she is a Greek, but she is the only Ptolemy who learns ancient Egyptian, and she is trying to reestablish the ancient religion. She dresses as the goddess Isis, and she attends rituals and festivals with the people. So they must have loved her. I mean, she's returning the Egypt that we know back. But then she dies, of course, and she is the last ruler. Then the Romans take over, and it's the end of Egyptian language and civilization.
We've only got 30 seconds left. What would you advise people going to the Science Center to look for specifically in this exhibit?
I think one of the things to do is go to the tomb and stand there. Take your time, look at the walls, look at the paintings, and understand that this is real history. This is Tutankhamun being buried in this tomb.
You're still very enthusiastic about all of this, and I know you've been at it for a while, but your enthusiasm really, really projects.
It's a great story. Thanks, Don.
It really is. Thank you so much, Bob Breyer, for being with us. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.